Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 1. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Watchman's Teaching Letter, Number 6, October 1998. From the 1998 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmaheiser. Read by Dan Adams. Just who is this Patriarch Judah? Part 6. In this issue, we are going to consider another angle on Judah. If I would have continued my usual chronological study of Judah, I would have eventually gotten to what we are going to study in this lesson. I feel it is important to skip ahead because I received a letter from a man, I won't say who he is, saying that the Sephardim Jews may be of the Satanic seed line, but the Ashkenazi cannot be, as they were only converted to Judaism. I thought about what he had said, and I said to myself, I wonder how many other people may be under this false illusion. Well, you say, what does this have to do with Judah? It has everything to do with Judah. It has everything to do with Judah because the Jews falsely claim to be of Judah. Revelation 2:9 and 3:9. With this lesson, we're going to prove that the Ashkenazi Jews are just as satanic as the Sephardim. If you have not read Arthur Koestler's book, The 13th Tribe, you will have some catching up to do. Also, if you have not read my research papers proving to seed line seduction of Eve, that the Jews are descendants of Cain, then you have more catching up to do. Basically, Arthur Koestler does a very good job of proving the Khazars of Khazaria were converted to Judaism. But he does not include all of the facts. With this lesson, we are going to consider some of these missing facts. A general view of the Khazars. Before I go into detail on the subject we are about to consider, I would like to give you a short overview concerning the Khazars. You will notice the word Khazar is spelled various ways, so don't let that confuse you as we go along. To get this short overview of the subject, I'm going to quote from the Collier's Encyclopedia of 1985. Khazars, Khazars is the usual spelling, a semi-nomadic tribe of Turkish or Tartar origin who first appeared north of the Caucasus in the early part of the 3rd century. In the 7th century, the Khazars conquered the kingdom of the Bulgars. They built up a strong and prosperous state, which attained its greatest size in the 9th century, when it extended from the Crimea to the Middle Volga and westward to the Dnieper River, including the city of Kiev. The Khazars developed some important commercial cities and carried on trade between Russia and Constantinople. The Khagan, now usually spelled K-A-G-A-N, or ruler of the Khazars, was also the religious head of the state. Church and state were undivided. Tolerant of other religions, the Khagan welcomed thousands of Jews from Asia Minor and the Byzantine Empire, as well as many Muslims and Christians. These three religious groups vied with one another to convert the Khazars, who had a primitive, idolatrous belief. In the 8th century, the 700s, Khagan Bulan, spelt B-U-L-A-N, decided in favor of the Jews and accepted Judaism for himself and for his people, but the Khazar state continued religious tolerance. Tenth century. He may sate this, he may sate this below, but at this time only the king and his nobles accepted Judaism, not all of the Khazars. It was finally overthrown in 965, the 10th century, by a coalition of the Christian Russians and Byzantines. The Khazars soon disappeared, either fleeing to Central Asia or intermingling with other peoples in southern Russia. The last vestiges of the Khazars in the Crimea were destroyed by the Greeks and Russians in 1016. The Khazars as a group are no more. The important thing to note in the quote above is the part, the Khagan welcomed thousands of Jews from Asia Minor and the Byzantine Empire. You have to understand that these Jews who were swarming into Khazaria were the Sephardim, which were expelled from Jerusalem in 70 AD. These were Jews that can be traced back to Cain. We're going to go into detail how these Jews from Asia Minor and the Byzantine Empire happened to migrate to Khazaria, to show how the Khazars were converted to Judaism by these Asia Minor Sephardim Jews. We will use the Jews' own history books and let them tell you in their own words. We're going to start by quoting The History of the Jews by Heinrich Graetz. His name is spelt G-R-A-E-T-Z. Proper pronunciation is Heinrich Graetz. Volume 3 of a set of 7 volumes, pages 138 through 140. The Jews' own words. The heathen king of a barbarian people living in the north, together with all his court, adopted the Jewish religion. The Khazars or Khozars, a nation of Finnish origin related to the Bulgars, Avars, Ugars, or Hungarians, had settled after the dissolution of the Empire of the Huns on the frontier between Europe and Asia. They had founded a kingdom on the Volga, which they called the Etil, or Atel, at the place near which it runs into the Caspian Sea, in the neighborhood of Astrakhan, now the home of the Kalmucks, spelt K-A-L-M-U-C-K-S. Their kings, who bore the title of Khagan or Khachan, modern spelling K-A-G-A-N, had led these warlike sons of the steppe from victory to victory. The Khazars inspired the Persians with so great a dread that Chosroes, one of their kings, found no other way of protecting his dominions against their violent invasions than by building a strong wall which blocked up the passes between the Caucasus and the sea. But this gate of gates, Babal Abwab, near Derbend, did not long serve as a barrier against the warlike courage of the Khazars. After the fall of the Persian Empire, they, the Khazars, crossed the Caucasus, invaded Armenia, and conquered the Crimean Peninsula, which bore the name Khazaria for some time. The Byzantine Empire trembled at the name of the Khazars, flattered them, and paid them a tribute in order to restrain their lust after the booty of Constantinople. The Bulgarians and other tribes were the vassals of the Khazars, and the people of Kiev, Russians on the Dnieper, were obliged to pay them as an annual tax a sword and a fine skin for every household. With the Arabs, whose near neighbors they gradually became, they carried on terrible wars. Like their neighbors, the Bulgarians and the Russians, the Khazars professed a coarse religion which was combined with sensuality and lewdness. inherited from the Canaanites. The Khazars became acquainted with Islam and Christianity through the Arabs and Greeks who came to the capital, Balanyer, on matters of business. In order to exchange the products of their countries for fine furs, there were also Jews in the land of the Khazars. They were some of the fugitives that had escaped in 723 from the mania for conversion which possessed the Byzantine Emperor Leo. It was through these Greek Jews that the Khazars became acquainted with Judaism. As interpreters or merchants, physicians or counselors, the Jews were known and beloved by the Khazar court, and they inspired the warlike king Bulan with the love of Judaism. In subsequent times, however, the Khazars had but a vague knowledge of the motive which induced their forefathers to embrace Judaism. One of their later Khagans gives the following account of their conversion, of their conversation. The king Bulan conceived a horror of the foul idolatry of his ancestors and prohibited its exercise within his dominions. So much for religious freedom. Without, however, adopting any other form of religion, he was encouraged by a dream in his endeavors to discover the proper manner of worshiping God. Having gained a great victory over the Arabs and conquered the Armenian fortress of Ardalib, Bulan determined to adopt the Jewish religion openly. The Caliph and Byzantine Emperor desired, however, to induce the King of the Khazars to embrace their respective religions, and with this intention sent to Bulan deputations with letters and valuable presents and men well versed in religious matters. The king thereupon arranged for a religious discussion to take place before him between a Byzantine ecclesiastic, a Mahometan sage, and a learned Jew. The champions of the three religions disputed the whole question, however, without being able to convince one another or the king of the superior excellence of their respective religions as compared with the other two. But as Bulan had remarked that the representatives of the religion of Christ and of Islam both refer to Judaism as the foundation and point of departure of their faiths, he declared to the ambassadors of the Caliph and the Emperor that, as he had heard from opponents of Judaism themselves, an impartial avowal of the excellence of that religion, he would carry out his intention of professing Judaism as his religion. Of interest to note, the Hebrewism, or as it later became known as Judaism, does not allow or recognize Mamzers, bastards, into the congregation of Yahweh forever. Therefore, all converts outside of a circumscribed Israelite heritage would have been spurious. Just to know. I don't know how much of the above quotation you understand, but I want to repeat the part I understand it as important in understanding what is going on here. There were also Jews in the land of the Khazars. They were some of the fugitives that had escaped in 723 from the mania for conversion which possessed the Byzantine Emperor Leo. It was thought, these Greek Jews, that the Khazars became acquainted with Judaism. As interpreters or merchants, physicians or counselors, the Jews were known and beloved by the Khazar court, and they inspired the warlike King Bulan with the love of Judaism. Now, we have to find out what was going on in the Byzantine Empire in 723 AD and what Emperor Leo had to do with it. To understand this, we'll go to page 122 through 124 of this same book, The History of the Jews, by Heinrich Graetz, volume 3 of a set of 7 volumes. At about this time, the Jews of the Byzantine Empire were subjected to severe persecution, from the effect of which they did not for a long time recover, and this too at the hands of a monarch from whom they had least expected hostile treatment. Leo the Isaurian, the son of a rude peasant, parents, having had his attention drawn by the Jews and Arabs to the idolatrous character of the image worship which obtained in the churches, had undertaken a campaign with the intention of destroying these images. Being denounced, however, before the uncultivated mob as a heretic and a Jew by the image-worshipping clergy, Leo proceeded to vindicate his orthodoxy by persecuting the heretics and the Jews. He issued a decree commanding all Jews of the Byzantine Empire and the remnant of the Montanists, Christians looking for Yahshua's return in their day, in Asia Minor, to embrace the Christianity of the Greek Church under pain of severe punishment in 723. Many Jews submitted to this decree and reluctantly received baptism. They were thus less steadfast than the Montanists, who, in order to remain faithful to their conviction, assembled in their house of prayer, set fire to it, and perished in the flames. This sounds very similar to a Jim Jones-style cult. It's my note. Such of the Jews had allowed themselves to be baptized were the opinion of the storm would soon blow over and that they would be permitted to return to Judaism, their true religion is Satanism, falsely accusing others. It was therefore only outwardly that they embraced Christianity, for they observed the Jewish rites in secret, thereby subjecting themselves to fresh persecutions. Thus the Jews of the Byzantine Empire pined away under unceasing petty persecution, and for a time they are hidden from the view of history. Many Jews of the Byzantine Empire, however, escaped compulsory baptism by emigration. They left a country in which their forefathers had settled long before the rise of that church which had so persistently persecuted them. The Jews of Asia Minor, Byzantine, chose as their home the neighboring Cimmerian of Tauric Peninsula, the Crimea, whose uncivilized inhabitants of Scythian, Finnish, and Sclavonian origin practiced idolatry. These Alani, Bulgarians, and Khazars were, however, not jealous of men of other race and of a different belief who settled in their vicinity. Thus, side by side with the Jewish communities which had existed from early times, there arose new communities on the shores of the Black Sea and the Straits of Theodosia, Kaffa, and in the interior, the Solchat, Solgat, now Eski Crimea, in Phanagoria, now Taman, and on the Bosporus, Kerch, which lies opposite. From the Crimea, the Greek Byzantine Jews spread toward the Caucasus and the hospitable countries of the Khazars on the west coast of the Caspian Sea and at the mouth of the Volga, Atel. Jewish communities settled in Berda'a, Derbend, at the Albanian gates, in Semender, Tarki, and finally in Balanier, the capital of the land of the Khazars. By their energy, ability, and intelligence, the Greek Jewish emigrants speedily acquired power in the midst of these barbarian nations and prepared the way for an important historical event. What we have in the above quote on pages 122 through 124 are a large number of Sephardic, Cain, Satanic Jews migrating from Asia Minor of the Byzantine Empire into the land of the Khazars. There were thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these Sephardic descendants of Cain in this migration. The conversion of King Bulan was in 740 AD, and then the mixing of the Sephardic and Ashkenazi started to take place. They have now had 1,275 years to mix the blood of Cain among themselves, making them all satanic. Understood? There are no non-Cain Jews. Let's consider another Jewish source on this subject from The History of the Jews by Paul Goodman, revised and enlarged by Israel Cohen, pages 87 through 89. The Khazars, the Jewish forces in Babylonia, had been fatally weakened by the decay and final extinction of the venerable and universally received dignities of the Prince of the Captivity and the Gaonate, the Karaites, had created the first and only irreparable schism in the body of Israel, Jews. The once tolerant and enlightened caliphs had begun to persecute the unbelieving Jews and Christians with equal impartiality. Even the Byzantine emperor Leo the Assyrian, being accused of execrable Judaizing tendencies on account of his iconoclastic against statues activities, cleared himself of all suspicion by subjecting the Jews to cruel persecution. Yet these were only the labors preceding the birth of one of the greatest and most fruitful epochs of Jewish history. From widely different quarters, at the shores of the Euxine and the gates of Hercules, on the banks of the Volga and Guadalquivir, Judaism received unexpected accessions of strength, while on the Rhine also the old Jewish tree blossomed out with renewed splendor. Of greater consequence was the migration of the Jews along the trade routes of the Black Sea and the Volga. In this region lived the Khazars, a people of Tartar race, whose Khagan, Bulan, together with his nobles adopted the Jewish religion about 740. The common Khazar people kept their pagan religion, even though it is now considered pagan to choose one's religion, no matter what it is. From the scanty records that have been preserved of this Jewish kingdom of the Khazars, which subsisted for a period of about 250 years, it appears that it had its capital, Atel, near the present Astrakhan, on the Volga, while the Khazarian territory stretched all over the south of Russia. The incursions of the Khazars were so dreaded by the Persians that they built a great wall across the Caucasus to keep them away, while Imperial Byzantium had to buy off their hostility by ill-disguised payments, and the Russian dukes of Kiev were forced to recognize the authority of the Jewish Khagans of the Khazars by a fixed tribute. The country of the Jewish Khazars was governed in a spirit of exceptional tolerance, so that, for instance, the Supreme Court of Justice was composed of two Jews, two Christians, two Mohammedans, and one pagan, to represent the Russians and Bulgars. The Khagan Obadiah, for those who know, this is the height of irony, the successor of Bulan, invited a number of Jewish teachers into his country to instruct the people in the tenets of Judaism, and it was only the difficulties of distance and travel which kept the Jewish state from the general knowledge of the Jews. This Jewish state was a state way back then. It was thought ambassadors from Byzantium that Hasdai ibn Shaprut, a Jewish statesman at the court of Cordoba in the middle of the 10th century, became acquainted with the fact of their existence, and it is to an extent correspondence he initiated with the Khagan Joseph, that we are indebted for our information regarding the Jewish Khazars. They maintained their power until the year 969, when Sviatoslav, Duke of Kiev, conquered the capital and territory of the Khazars. Many of them withdrew to the Crimea, which also became known as Khazaria, but their political power had gone, and they were lost in the mass of Jews and Karaites who had settled there, and in southeastern Europe generally. End of the quote. Now we shall investigate the history that led up to the persecution of the Sephardim Jews, which ultimately drove them massively into the Khazarian Empire. The next quotation will be taken from The Story of Civilization, Part 4, The Age of Faith by Will Durant, pages 425 and 426. Leo III, Leo the Isaurian, derived his cognomen, surname, from the district of Isauria in Cilicia, according to Theophanes. He was born there of Armenian parentage. His father moved thence to Thrace, raised sheep, and sent 500 of them with his son Leo in the bargain as a present to the Emperor Justinian II. Leo became guardsman of the palace, then commander of the Anatolian legions. Finally, by the convincing suffrage of the army, emperor. He was a man of ambition, strong will, and patient perseverance, a general who repeatedly defeated Muslim forces greatly superior to his own, a statesman who gave the empire the stability of just laws, justly enforced, reformed taxation, reduced serfdom, extended peasant proprietorship, distributed lands, repopulated deserted regions, and constructively revised the laws. His only fault was autocracy. Perhaps in his Asiatic youth he had imbibed from Muslims, Jews, Manichaeans, Monophysites, and Polycians a Stoic Puritan conception of religion that condemned the addiction of popular Christianity to image worship, ceremonialism, and superstition. The Old Testament, Deuteronomy 4:15, had explicitly forbidden any graven image of any figure, male or female, the likeness of any beast that is on the earth. The early church had frowned upon images as relics of paganism and had looked with horror upon pagan sculptures purporting to represent the gods. But the triumph of Christianity under Constantine and the influence of Greek surroundings, traditions, and statuary in Constantinople and the Hellenistic East had softened this opposition. As the number of worshipped saints multiplied, a need arose for identifying and remembering them. Pictures of them and of Mary were produced in great number. And in the case of Christ, not only his imagined form, but his cross became objects of reverence, even for simple minds, magic talismans. A natural freedom of fancy among the people turned the holy relics, pictures, and statues into objects of adoration. People prostrated themselves before them, kissed them, burned candles and incense before them, crowned them with flowers, and sought miracles from their occult influence. Paganism. That's all this is. In Greek Christianity, especially sacred images were everywhere, in churches, monasteries, houses, and shops, even on furniture, trinkets, and clothes. Cities in danger from epidemic, famine, or war tended to rely upon the power of relics that they harbored, or on their patron saint, rather than on human enterprise. Fathers and councils of the church repeatedly explained that the images were not deities, but only reminders thereof. The people did not care to make such distinctions. Leo III was offended by these excesses of popular faith. It seemed to him that paganism was in this manner reconquering Christianity, and he felt keenly that satire directed by Muslims, Jews, and Christian sects against the superstitions of the Orthodox multitude. His observation was correct, but what he did about it caused other mishaps. To weaken the power of the monks over the people and the government, to win the support of Nestorians and Monophysites, Leo assembled a great council of bishops and senators, and with their consent he promulgated in 726 an edict requiring the complete removal of icons from the churches. Representations of Christ and the Virgin were forbidden, and church murals were to be covered with plaster. Some of the higher clergy supported the edict. The lower clergy and monks protested. The people revolted. Soldiers trying to enforce the law were attacked by worshippers, horrified and infuriated by this desecration of the dearest symbols of their faith. In Greece and the Cyclades, rebel forces proclaimed a rival emperor and sent a fleet to capture the capital. Leo promptly destroyed the fleet and imprisoned the leaders of the opposition. In Italy, where pagan forms of worship never died, the people were almost unanimous against the edict. Venice, Ravenna, and Rome drove out the imperial officers, and a council of Western bishops, summoned by Pope Gregory II, anathemized the iconoclasts, the image breakers, without naming the emperor. The Patriarch of Constantinople joined in the revolt and sought by it to restore the independence of the Eastern Church from the state. So Leo deposed him in 730, but did him no violence. And the edict was so mildly enforced that when Leo died in 741, most of the churches retained their frescoes and mosaics unharmed. We'll find here some more information about the Jewish persecution that was going on as a result of the image breaking at this period from this same book. And we'll quote again from The Story of Civilization, Part 4, The Age of Faith, by Will Durant, page 389. The Byzantine emperors continued for 2 centuries the oppressive politics of Justinian towards the Jews. Heraclius, from 628, banished them from Jerusalem in retaliation for their aid to Persia, and did all he could to exterminate them. Leo the Assyrian sought to disprove the rumor that he was Jewish by a decree in 723 giving Byzantine Jews a choice between Christianity or banishment. Some submitted, some burned themselves to death in their synagogues rather than yield. I'm having to present a lot of history here in order to make understandable the extent of the movement against the images and how it affected the migration of the Jews out of the Byzantine Empire and into the friendly area of Khazaria. It was a natural movement for the Sephardic to make, as the Khazars were very tolerant with all religions. Not only was Leo the Assyrian involved with this anti-image movement, but it continued altogether for 120 years by him and his successors. In 120 years, there was a lot of time for a great number of these Sephardic Jews to move out of the Byzantine Empire. I'm going to use another quote from the Manual of Universal Church History by the Reverend Dr. John Alzog, Volume 2, from a 3-volume work, pages 207 to 209, under the heading Byzantine Iconoclasts. Just to state here, although this comes out of a universalist manual, I do not promote universalism in any manner, shape, or form. I use this reference for its historic value only. The origin of this deplorable controversy is usually ascribed to Leo the Assyrian, a rude and ignorant soldier who, rising from the humblest walks of life, finally succeeded by the aid of the army in reaching the imperial throne in AD 717. Having already employed violent measures to compel the Jews to receive baptism and driven the Montanists to such a degree of desperation that they frequently resorted to suicide to escape his tyranny, he next turned his attention to the task of suppressing the use of images. He brought to the contest the fierce spirit of the lawgiver of Mecca rather than the moderation of the one of Sinai, declaring he could not endure that Christ should be represented under the form of a dumb and senseless figure made of coarse material and bedaubed with vulgar colors, and that such representations would shock both Jews and Mohammedans and repel them from Christianity. He therefore assumed the office of a self-constituted reformer of the church, pardon me, a Hitler, and set about putting an end to this superstition. He commenced by ordering Pope Gregory II to have the images and paintings on the walls of the churches raised sufficiently high to be beyond reach of the embraces and kisses of the devout multitude, thus, as he thought, preventing profanation and removing the occasion of sin. Finding that his order was ineffectual, he published in the year 726, in spite of the representations and protests of Germanus, Patriarch of Constantinople, and other theologians of the capital, an edict forbidding the veneration of statues, images, and mosaics, and the branding of practice as idolatrous. This edict was shortly followed by a second, in and around 730, of a far more severe and sweeping character, ordering the complete destruction of all images throughout the Western Empire. No words can convey an adequate idea of the agitation and tumult which followed its proclamation. The question, unlike any abstruse definition of a dogma or authoritative solution of subtle point of metaphysics, was written, within the comprehension of the multitude and bore directly upon their religious life and devotional habits. It has been said that if an order were issued at the present day, 1872, commanding the breaking and destroying of all the statues and images of the Blessed Virgin set up along the country highways and metropolitan thoroughfares of any Catholic country of Europe, no such revulsion of feeling would take place as that which followed the promulgation of Leo's edict. No such revulsion of feeling would take place as that which followed the promulgation of Leo's edict. Do you get that? In 1872, by that time, smash as many as you care for. We don't care. The soldiers charged with his execution were treated with every sort of indignity and frequently lost their lives endeavoring to carry instructions into effect. Above the bronze portal of the imperial palace stood a magnificent image of Christ, which was held in great reverence by the people. According to Theophanes and Cedrenus, the destroying of this was the occasion of a popular tumult in which many of the participants paid with their lives the penalty of their devotion. When a soldier of the Imperial Guard had placed a ladder against the gateway for the purpose of taking down the image, a number of ladies collected around begged him to spare it for their own sakes. But instead of heeding their remonstrances and acceding to their wishes, he struck the face of the image a blow with his axe, an act which so wounded the religious sensibilities and so excited the indignation of the ladies that, forgetting for the time the gentleness of their sex and yielding to the fierce impulse of the moment, they drew the ladder from under the soldier's feet, precipitating him to the ground, set upon him, and murdered him. The chief opposition came from the monks who supplied the images and the bulk of the people who entertained great reverence for them. I could go on with this subject about the images for a long time, but I think you can see by now the importance of these events in connection with the forced migration of the Sephardic Jews out of the Byzantine Empire into the Khazar Empire. What is interesting in Arthur Kessler's book, The 13th Tribe, is the fact that he only devotes a single phrase within one sentence about the persecution of the Jews in the Byzantine Empire. This is the phrase found on page 16, in defiance of Christian proselytizing by Byzantium. Kessler's not completely honest with this presentation. He tells you a lot of truth, but leaves you with the impression that the Jews are a religion and not a race. The Jews are of many races, but they have one thing in common. They all have the blood of Cain flowing in their veins. I recommend that any of you who haven't read Kessler's book do so, but remember, he has something to hide. Now, on page 22, Kessler, for a moment, leaves the cat out of the bag in describing the looks of some of the Khazars. Let's read it. Lastly, the Arab geographer, Istakhri, one of the main Arab sources, has this to say: the Khazars do not resemble the Turks. They are black-haired and are of two kinds, one called the Kara Khazars, the black Khazars, who are swarthy, verging on deep black, as if they were a kind of Indian, and a white kind, the Akh Khazars, who are strikingly handsome. This is more flattering, but only adds to the confusion, for it was customary among the Turkish peoples to refer to the ruling classes or clans as white, to the lower strata as black. This does not add to the confusion, as these dark-haired, swarthy Khazars describe the Sephardic Jews perfectly. I think Kessler is, again, trying to throw you off the track. I would trust the Arab before I would trust Kessler. No doubt, after the Jew from Asia Minor was among the Khazars long enough, he was also referred to as a Khazar. Where have we seen that before? Once an Edomite is a Judean, he becomes referred to as a Judean. It's the same trick they always practice. So again on page 25, Kessler mentions a very adept, famed rhetorician by the name of Priscus of the Byzantine Empire. Let's read his comment. Priscus also has anecdotes to tell about a people subject to the Huns, whom he calls Akh Khazars, that is, very likely the Akh Khazars, or white Khazars, as distinct from the black Kara Khazars. Now we'll pick up another witness to this mixing of Sephardim stock with the Ashkenazi stock. Going to quote from an article out of The Forum, March 1926, volume 75, number 3, entitled The Pedigree of Judah by Lothrop Stoddard, which I should point out is a better anthropologist than a Bible student. In pages 16 through 18. The evolution of Eastern Jewry is at once more obscure and more complicated. Their propensity was gravely compromised by the Mohammedan conquest and conversion of Mesopotamian Persia in the 7th century A.D. Harried and persecuted by Muslim zealots, the Jews grew restless and sought an avenue of escape. They presently found it in the northward, in the plains of southern Russia, where opportunities beckoned them perhaps more favorable than ever before in their history. Southern Russia was then occupied by the people known as the Khazars. Precisely what the Khazars were racially is a much disputed point. Probably they were predominantly a broad-nosed Turkish stock from Central Asia, together with a strong strain of flat-nosed, short-statured Mongoloids from still farther eastward. They, Khazars, certainly built up a flourishing state which derived its prosperity from its command of the overland trading routes between Near and Middle East, the Khazars being a mercantile, town-dwelling people. From the first, they had been in contact, describes, with the numerous Jews of the Caucasus, and two peoples had got along well enough together. Soon the Jews of Khazaria became so numerous and influential that they made a cultural and spiritual conquest of their hosts. The Khazars became converted to Judaism and established what amounted to a Jewish state. This acted like a magnet to the whole of Eastern Jewry, and one of those vast mass migrations which have occurred several times in Jewish history took place. In the 8th century AD, the 700s, Mesopotamia, Persia, and the Armenian Caucasus area still contained the bulk of the world's Jewish population. By the end of the 10th century, the 900s, these lands were almost emptied of Jews. Lured to Khazaria as the promised land, Jewry pushed northward from Asia into southeastern Europe, swarming in by the 100,000, by sea, river, and by mountain trail. And during those two centuries was forged the Ashkenazic stock of today. This migration involved sweeping racial changes. In the first place, Jewry's slow progress through the Armenian Caucasian highlands implied further admixture and strengthening of the Armenoid at the expense of the Semitic racial element. This is idiotic, literally. Then, once in Khazaria, extensive intermarriage with the converted Khazars resulted in a further influx of Turkish and Mongoloid blood. The result was a population prevailingly round-headed and thick-set, but with two outstanding facial types, the full-faced, hook-nosed Armenoid and the flat-faced, squat or pug-nosed Mongoloid, respectively. The Semitic type must have almost entirely disappeared. The consequences of this racial transformation were as unprecedented as they were far-reaching. Hitherto, the base elements in Jewry's ethnic makeup had been either Semitic or Armenoid, waxing and waning in relative importance from age to age. It is true, yet always preponderate, no other racial element having been sufficiently important to shake their joint significance. Now, for the first time, radically new ethnic elements from Central and Eastern Asia were injected into the Jewish blood, and injected in such volume as powerfully and permanently to alter the nature of the great mass of the Jewish people. More rubbish. They were always mixed with someone or something. The notion of Jews being pure blood in any sense is idiotic. The profound difference is not merely in physical appearance, but also in mentality and temperament, which exist between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, are thus clearly explained. They are obviously due to almost complete differences in racial makeup. The Sephardim have for the past 1,000 years been breeding away from the old Armenoid towards the long-headed Semitic and Mediterranean racial types. More crap. The Ashkenazim, on the contrary, have not only been breeding away from the Semitic toward the Armenoid type, but have also taken up a great amount of Central Asian and Mongoloid blood, which was unknown to ancient Jewry and which has never flowed in Sephardim's veins. Great as this present difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, however, it is not quite as great as the divergence 800 or 900 years ago, owing to certain minor modifications which have since taken place. The evolution of the modern Ashkenazim was not quite complete. By the 11th century, the Khazar Empire, grown rich and warlike, collapsed before the assaults of its enemies, and the Jewish masses, again fallen on evil times, drifted slowly westward in search of better opportunities. Seeping across southern Russia, they began to appear in Poland. This movement was soon accelerated by the action of the Polish kings, intent on building up a strong state. The Polish monarchs welcomed the Jews in order to build up a middle class devoted to industry and trade. Immediately, Poland became what Khazaria had once been, a magnet of Jewish mass migration. And these Jewish immigrants, though mainly from the East, came in lesser numbers from the West as well. Western Europe had by that time become the scene of bitter anti-Jewish persecution, so that there also many Jews heeded the welcome summons of the Polish crown. Here then, on Polish soil, the long-sundered branches of Jewry met once again. The immigration from Western Europe were, of course, Sephardim, and though too few in number materially to affect the Ashkenazic physical type, they did impose their superior culture, and debased form of their Germanic speech, which mixed with Hebrew, Slavic, and other linguistic elements, constitutes the present jargon known as Yiddish, employed by the Polish Jews to this day. The slight infusion of Sephardic blood gained during the Middle Ages, together with considerable Slavic blood picked up during their migrations through Russia and Poland, complete the racial evolution of the modern Ashkenazic stock in its present Polish home. There is a possibility that the Khazars may already have had some of Cain's satanic blood flowing in their veins before the mass migration of the Sephardim Jews into Khazaria and the conversion of King Bulan. We learn from Genesis 15, 19 through 21 that the Canaanites, Jews, were made up from 10 different nations. The first mention of these were the Kenites, K-E-N-I-T-E-S, who were descendants of Cain. The fourth mentioned are the Hittites, H-I-T-T-I-T-E-S. It is a pretty well accepted fact, even by standard Bible commentaries, that these two nations mixed with each other to become commonly known as Canaanites. Knowing that the Hittites were among them, let's take another quote from The Forum, March 1926, volume 75, number 3, entitled The Pedigree of Judah by Lathrop Stoddard, which I should point out is a better a better anthropologist than a Bible student, page 12. Even more striking is the parallel between the ancient Hittites and a large proportion of the modern Ashkenazim. One cannot look at a Hittite sculpture without being struck by the Jewishness of the face there depicted. The famous Jewish nose, with its peculiarly hooked nostrils, is found to be not exclusively Jewish, but to have been shared by the ancient Hittites and also by modern peoples of the West Asiatic Highlands. Many Armenians, Caucasians, and Anatolians today look so much like this type of Jew that it is practically impossible to distinguish them by their physical appearance. Here, then, we seem to have found two primal elements in Jewry's racial makeup, an ancient cross between Semitic and Hittite Arminoid stocks, which was the original root, almost certainly the Semitic. The entire weight of evidence tends to show that the Jews were originally a tribe of nomadic Semites who migrated from the desert lands on the southward into Palestine, geographically a borderland between Arabia and the West Asian highlands. Here they encountered folk of Hittite-like stock and took up a certain amount of Hittite blood, though for a long time the Semitic strain must have predominated. End quote. Now that you have some understanding of the Jewish question and understand that the blood of Cain is flowing in both the Sephardim and Ashkenazic branches of Jewry, take time and listen to some of the stupid statements made by people like Ted R. Whelan, James W. Brueggemann, Stephen E. Jones, Charles Wiseman, and Pete Peters, and you'll begin to understand how false their teachings are. They will tell you that the Jews of Christ's time were pure-blooded Israelites. What more proof do you need to understand they are teaching you lies? I could have gone on several more pages with documentation that the Sephardim and Ashkenazi continued to mix since the conversion of Balaam. Some of the Khazars went to Spain, while many, many Sephardim went to Khazaria. It is my deepest desire that this presentation will clear up this issue in your minds so you can get it out of the way and go on to deeper truths. Two-seed line is the only truth concerning Jews. The most important thing you have to do is prove these things for yourself. Revised on the 14th of February of 2001 by Clifton Emmaheiser. This brings the Watchman's Teaching Letter No. 6 to a close. Thank you for listening.